I saw a lot of my peers transition and do better films. They would just make these beautiful films, and I was like, I want to do that. I think it was just, I was, when you first start out, you're kind of lost. You're like, I have a little bit of sports, I have a little bit of small business. There's all these little things that you dabble in, and it was understanding my limit of a solopreneur videographer where you have to record sound, do the lighting, do the cameras, plan it, like
Edit.
produce it, direct it, shoot it, list goes on. And so when you reach that ceiling of feeling like this is too much for me to take on, then you slowly start to hire other people and you expand your budget to say, you know what, in order for me to execute this properly, let me bring on one more person. And then it started to become, okay, let me bring on like two more people, or let me bring on an editor. And then the team kind of started to grow that way. And the budgets also grew because if I were to do something with more people involved, usually not all the time, but you would hope that the image quality is better.
All right, and we are tuning in here to episode number 14 of the Sports Creative Showcase. So whether you're watching on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, Apple Podcast, not music, this is a podcast. Hope you guys are ready for another fantastic episode with another fantastic guest. With me today, I have a very good friend. I don't know, I would call you an old friend. It's been 5 years.
Has it been 5 years?
It's been like, well, yeah, it's been 5 years.
Damn.
A very good friend, one of my best friends, not just in the industry, but best friends in general. Joining me today is Nicole Shapiro, who is a commercial cinematographer, DP, based out of Toronto. Nicole, for those who don't know and haven't followed her yet, has basically done almost everything and everything you can do in the commercial world, from music videos, high-end commercials for brands, does her own spec work, started off shooting sports, which is kind of why I have you here. Not really ingrained in the sports world of things, but you have your origins in sport, which is kind of why I asked you to be here. She's also a very strong businesswoman, does her own taxes. I think she has an accountant, but
I definitely have
very
an
good at
accountant.
managing a QuickBooks page, and just an overall great person who is also building her brand as an educator in the space and as someone who wants, you know, people to ask her questions and, you know, get general guidance on how to be a freelancer, how to be a cinematographer in the space. I'm going to stop hyping you up here and let you introduce yourself.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat. There's so many questions to get into. I know your audience is very much so sport-based, so I'd love to chat about the past as well and, you know, get my insight on the sport world. But yeah, I still kind of shoot sports
Yeah,
sometimes, but
you have projects that involve
yeah.
sports, but I think when I talk about you, it's way more to people who want to know more about the commercial and want to know
Yeah,
more about
totally.
shooting music videos or shooting you know, brand spots and things like that. But I think that you learned a lot through your early career as a cinematographer or sports videographer that you've translated a lot into it. And yes, like we just for context, we work a lot together. If you guys aren't familiar with our kind of connection business-wise, we've worked on things for Kia Nurse before. We just did a PWHL shoot a few weeks ago. We have a short film that we're working on right now. That's sports focused. So I think when we work together, it's typically like we come to each other when it's like a sports thing because you know that's my strength and I know I can depend on you for that. But you know, I've also seen you work on music video sets. I've also seen you work on commercial sets. I've seen you kind of do it all. Can you give us some background on how you got started in this field? Taking me all the way back to the when you started getting into this creative side of things and got your camera and started shooting.
Yeah, the OG days of, I think I would say 2017 or 2018. I went to school at Laurier for kinesiology. I have a degree. I graduated with that. And
I forgot to
I.
mention that the you're also in a big thing here is that you went to school, but you don't use your degree, but I'll let you go on.
Totally. And the degree is obviously within the sport world. So in my fourth year, I was the athletic trainer for the men's basketball team at Laurier, and we had two athletic trainers. So we would have tasks like taping ankles, you know, running the ice baths, all of the athlete rehab care that
Yeah.
you would usually do, sometimes run workouts, warm-ups, that kind of thing. And so because we had two, it was myself and another dude, and I would be able to do the pre and post kind of sports therapy stuff, and he would do in game. And so when the game would when the game was on, I was able to just grab my camera and shoot around. And so Lori doesn't have a big sports media program like Ryerson or TMU does, or and basically any of the Toronto
now universities it's everywhere. Or colleges. Now it's everywhere.
But before, I guess this was 2019. They didn't really have this big media program. So I was kind of the first one to introduce video into the scene, into the Lori scene, at least. There was a couple volunteer photographers that would come and, you know, do the media days or anything.
Yeah, all that. Shoot photos at games. Yeah.
So I was kind of that first one, and it was so much fun. I remember I was...
You got to go to Paris.
I got to go to Paris.
I remember. I almost forgot about that.
I want to spend a little moment to just, I don't know, show gratitude for that specific moment in my life, because I was so in the mindset of I was going to be an athletic trainer of some sort, strength and conditioning coach. Shout out Elena Luciani. She was actually the strength and conditioning coach at the start of Laurier, trying to train the teams and stuff, getting programs implemented into all of the teams. And I really looked up to her. And so I think when fourth year came around and I started shooting just for fun, I realized how passionate I was for it. And you're supposed to do your thesis at the end of fourth year. And I remember probably writing it probably the week of, because I was so enamored with editing all of these hype reels. And I look back now and I just roll my eyes because they're hilarious hype reel basketball videos, you know,
we've all done those.
To Drake and Gunna and, you know, just like rap. Yeah. And it was fun though. I loved it. I always wanted to just stay awake late at night editing all of these things instead of doing my actual degree. So that only really came in fourth year, which is crazy because it took me 4 years to realize that. My idol kind of transitioned from Elena Luciani, who was like a strength and conditioning coach, to Cassie Athena. And I was able to see her be in these rooms with 6 foot plus tall men. And, you know, she's also, I think, is pretty tall from what I see in pictures. But to be a woman in the space where you're photographing all of these dudes, I was just super inspired. I was like, oh my God, if she can do it, I can probably do it too. So yeah, she was my main influence. When we graduated after fourth year, our coach, Justin Suresh, he's from France. And so he had a lot of connections back at home with some of the rep leagues and the
organizations there.
All of those organizations. So they all kind of gathered a tournament throughout France, and we all with the team, like the entire team, it was me and Lindsay, who is the team's manager. We all went to France and it was insane. It was the cool, like that was, I think, another moment of, oh my God, I can really do a lot with this skill that I have. Mm-hmm. I can open so many doors. I would have never gone to France. Why would I be going to France as someone who's in fourth year university? Like they just graduated, unless I have a ton of savings, you know, I'm not just
gonna for sure. It's an opportunity there. That like at the time you wouldn't imagine, but you and your skill with a camera and your passion for it got you there.
Yeah.
What caused you to pick up a camera in the first place? And when did you buy a camera and what was the kind of moment there?
The very first moment I picked up a camera was a GoPro.
As everyone is.
It was on S Trip, actually.
So you went on S Trip? This podcast is over.
Yeah, grade 12, I guess.
Oh my God.
Yeah, Punta Cana and just the GoPro. And we got one of those like big sticks that you just like.
Yeah.
And I made like a after movie and it got a lot of views. I don't even think it's online anymore. I've probably taken it down, but yeah, just that, I guess I saw kind of the creativity. And then I definitely got into weddings as well. That was like another chapter. I did an internship actually after I graduated. And I did two. So I did one with the strength and conditioning side and one with a company called Beautiful Life Studios. They're a wedding company. They do photo and video. And so right out the gate, after I graduate, I'm like, what do I do? Which one am I going to go?
What path am I going to choose?
Yeah. I'm like at a clear fork in the road. So I did two internships to see which one I was more passionate about. And it was so clear that the video one was the one that I wanted to choose. And it was also nice with the wedding industry because you can see that you can make money in it.
Yeah.
So it was a sustainable thing
that you can do to fund
that you could,
yeah,
you know, get into. So yeah, but I think my very first camera was the A6500. I remember that. And I'm pretty sure I bought that in fourth year. Like that was when I was doing the basketball stuff. I bought the kit lens, the 18-105
or whatever. Oh, the 18-105, goat, it's a goat.
Yep, and it was a crop sensor. It's a goated lens. You're doing basketball, you could zoom in all the way.
Who needs a 70-200?
No, exactly, so yeah. That was my first camera, but yeah, after that whole graduation and the internships, it kind of became really clear to me of, okay, I really love this. Even when I was at the gym doing the strength and conditioning internship, I was thinking, oh, this would be a sick angle, or like, I should ask them, I wonder if they need a video. You start seeing
it differently.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, your perspective changes. So, yeah.
No, that's awesome. And obviously you went from there, you did your internship at this wedding company, and you obviously, emphatically do not do weddings unless me and my business partner, Kyle, like lasagna, get on our knees and beg you to do
it.
Shout
out Caliente.
But no, so you move away from weddings and then you kind of find your niche in the commercial space.
Mm-hmm.
How did you kind of get into that spot of saying, I want to be a commercial cinematographer? And what steps did you take from then? Because I remember when we met 2021.
Yeah.
Or
we met like
2020. I met you the second year of the pandemic.
Really?
I think so.
I feel like it was 2019.
Well, we met through an organization.
I was working for an agency right after also I graduated. Okay. And I remember meeting you around that, like, it was like Richmond and Queen area. Didn't we like meet up or something? I don't know.
We did something for District.
Oh yeah.
So we started working with a brand. We knew some people called District back in the day, and that's how we met. But you still were kind of doing the videography stuff on the side. You were doing businesses, you were doing more smaller stuff.
Yeah.
How did you make that leap from, you know, just a videographer doing videos for people and small businesses to going into the commercial world? How did you decide you wanted to do it? And how did you get into it?
I saw a lot of my peers transition and do better films. They would just make these beautiful films. And I was like, I want to do that. I think it was just, when you first start out, you're kind of lost. You're like, I have a little bit of sports. I have a little bit of small business. There's all these little things that you dabble in. And I think that's where
kind of like a gun for hire, like a mercenary. You're just kind of doing everything and anything.
Chameleon. Yeah. And so that kind of the images that I started seeing, and it was a mix of understanding my limit understanding my limit of a solopreneur videographer, where you have to record sound, do the lighting, do the cameras, plan it, like produce it, direct it, shoot it, list goes on. And so when you reach that ceiling of feeling like this is too much for me to take on, then you slowly start to hire other people and you expand your budget to say, you know what, in order for me to execute this properly, let me bring on one more person. And then it started to become, okay, let me bring on like two more people, or let me bring on an editor. And then the team kind of started to grow that way. And the budgets also grew, because if I were to do something with more people involved, usually not all the time, but you would hope that the image quality is better.
The overall production value goes up significantly. And I think it's the adage of, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go further, go with other people. And I think you very much embodied that. Like, I remember when it would just be like you telling me I had a shoot and was doing all by myself. And now you're running, you know, production teams of plus 10 people that I've seen you do. And it is a very drastic shift. What did you learn in those early days of shooting sports that you carry with you now as a commercial cinematographer? Obviously, when you're shooting sports, it's much more run and gun, and you're much more reactive than what you do now. It's much more prepared. We'll get into that. But what did you learn in those early days shooting sports that kind of prepared you for what you do now?
Two things. I think there is still reactivity on set. And even if you're in the commercial space, you have a full shot lists, you have lighting plans, you have so much prep beforehand, but even on the day, stuff goes wrong all the time, all the time. Someone's late, someone doesn't show up.
Something doesn't work.
There's always something that you have to troubleshoot. And so that sense of urgency is 100% something that I translated. It's like, you have to
roll with the punches.
Think on your feet. You just have to, and as you do that, you still have to have a smile on. Like, nobody can see that you're bothered, because if they do, then the entire morale of the set can break apart.
Yeah, everyone gets rattled.
Yeah. So that's one thing I definitely translated, because there's that sense of urgency and that like being alert all the time, especially with sport. You're always rolling. You're literally always rolling to try to capture the moment. So
it's very much like you're very adaptive. You're adapting the situation and you're running and gunning.
Yep.
And I think that's the thing. Like, I think that prepared you, and I've seen you very much keep your cool and be very like even keel when shit does not go wrong,
or yeah,
when you're running out of time and you're like, we need to. And I think you only get that by being in an environment like sports and entertainment, where yep, you have in on a set. The biggest difference, in my opinion, between set work and working an event like a sporting event,
mm-hmm,
and the biggest roadblock I have when I go from doing set to, is the fact that you go from no control whatsoever to you control everything.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting for me that like you took that. And I think I'd like to say that, like, maybe you disagree with me around that, like, you are very adaptable because of your start and how you learned shooting.
Yeah.
You're shooting things in front of you as they happen, and you're going along with the flow. If I was to put you back to shoot sports, you'd be just fine. If I put other commercials and photographers who've never done that before, they would struggle a lot because you don't have that control.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very much like that is something that sets you apart from other people, is your adaptability and your willingness to, okay, this isn't going right, let's figure out how to do it.
Yeah. You know? It's just about also understanding there is always a solution. Sometimes the solution is we just cut the shot. Like, it's, and you just have to deal with it, you know, and there it's nothing will always go and execute. Nothing will be perfectly executed the way that you want it to in your head, but just know that, you know, you have all of these people around you, especially in the commercial space, where they're here to help. And like, if you're open, they can offer ideas. There's always a solution to a problem. Like, it's always no, but it's let's
like,
try this.
It's like, that's what we learn in improv. No. I took an improv class at university, and it's like the biggest thing is like, don't say no. You can say no, but mm-hmm, like offer a solution to the problem. Don't just put the brakes on and stop the car because yep, one thing went wrong. Like, the road trip's not over.
Yeah.
You and I have talked a lot about at length, and this was a couple of years ago. And we still have conversations about it. The transition from videographer to cinematographer.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be very careful with how we approach this topic, because people on TikTok and YouTube and everywhere love to be really aggressive. So we're going to tread on this though. You really wanted to move past the role of videographer. You wanted to become a cinematographer. You want to be a director of photography. What were the biggest challenges you face in doing that? And I also want to state, like, in no way are we talking down to videographers or people who aren't at the DP level yet. Some people might not even want to do it. Some people are just happy doing the videographer thing, but there is a difference. Mm-hmm. What was the biggest challenge you faced in doing it? And how did you find that transition?
So many challenges, so many hurdles, because when I first discovered that there even is a difference, because I come from a sport background. Like, I didn't even know the hierarchy. I didn't know the roles of a producer, an EP, a gaffer. Like, all of these names and terminology, they all, you know, I learned them slowly over time out of realization, you know, just by accident or whatever, by research. And so, no, understanding the difference between the two is number one, your first step of understanding, you know, what the actual tasks, how the tasks differ. I think because I don't come from the typical film background, there's a lot of movie references that I haven't seen. There's a lot of, you know, I guess like culturally relevant things that I didn't really know, I guess, because coming from the sport background, I always thought in my head, oh yeah, the commercial space, like anything that you need to sell online, or even stories like docu stuff is fun too. But like when you get into crafting an image and painting light and all of this, all of these like articulate details of the job, I didn't learn the technical way, you know, like I just learned from watching Danny Wirtz. I learned from watching
YouTube University,
The Wandering GP, like all of these idols that are on YouTube graciously sharing their knowledge. I tried to absorb that. But that's like one, I guess struggle. It might just be in my head too, but understanding what makes something cinematic, what makes something of higher quality, of movie quality, even though I don't want to make movies. So it's like,
how do you create an appeasing image on screen? How do you create something that is nice to look at?
Yeah. Nice to look at and tells the story properly, which is actually a really cool thing that I like to dive into. We recently just shot something, a commercial for Bumble that was so much fun. And we wanted to really be intentional about how the camera moves, what the lighting is going to look like, and how you want to feel watching it. There's so much reason behind things and, you know, like intentionality behind how you're going to craft things.
Yeah.
And that is like a huge process. And I guess when you go into shooting sports, at least from when I used to, and sometimes when I still do, I like last summer I shot for the Jays, which was so random. I just wandering around Rogers Center, you know, like with my FX3. But it, like super cool opportunity. But the one thing that I didn't do for those jobs was 2 weeks of pre-production, you know, like commercial stuff. You're thinking about the why, you're communicating with the director, you're understanding, hey, if I need to do this specific shot, this is the gear that I need to rent. There's so much prep. And with the Jays game or with any other like, you know, sports shoot, you show up and you shoot what you see. And I think
it's much more akin to documentary.
Yeah.
It's much more. And this is where I like kind of have my gripes with like when people say you're a videographer, like I think there's a certain level. And I think it's the same with how you use your environment and how you tell the story.
Yeah.
When I see someone shoot a sporting game and using the lights to their advantage, framing their shots up intentionally, actually making a story through the images rather than just shooting what's there, that's what makes the difference. And people will probably shit on me for saying sports videographers aren't cinematographers. I think there's a clear line where your skill level, and this also applies to commercial and just general videography / cinematography. There's a clear line where your skills and understanding of story, your understanding of shaping light, your understanding of
like framing too,
camera
framing.
Movement.
Yeah.
Both of those will take you to another level of where you're no longer a videographer. You are a director of photography. You are directing the image that you are seeing on screen and then translating it.
Yeah.
I also think you shoot, you've edited, you produce, you have a knowledge of each level of the process, which I think makes you a much more valuable asset behind the camera, because you're thinking about a lot of DPs when you talk to them. Not a lot of them, some of them will just have the image in mind and don't really think about the post because they're just like, I need to
or the cost
or the cost
too.
But some people,
like,
but
I think, want this lens, and I'm like, what budget is this? Like, come on.
But that's the thing. It's like you're there. But and that's not a bad thing. Some people are really fucking good at that.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's an advantage of having someone like you who understands the process of producing a shoot, organization, planning this out from top to bottom. You have an understanding of actually operating the camera. You have the understanding of understanding of lighting and everything. You also know how to edit. So you know how you're going to structure the story. So I think that really benefits you as to take that next leap into cinematography versus just videography. You have the whole thing in mind. You don't just have the one aspect, where a videographer might just be like, I want to shoot it and make an edit. You're like, this is what I want to do with this footage. You have the end product in mind. And I think that is a really big thing that not a lot of people talk about. And I'm just kind of realizing it now as I'm saying it. It's like, a part of being a cinematographer is understanding the full scope of the project and not just a fraction of it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for those watching who are interested in making that step, you just have to do it. You have to make things that maybe are, you know, not paid at first. That's what we call spec projects, where like the Bumble thing, I want to get hired for the specific job of, you know, being a cinematographer on a specific commercial set like this. I don't have anything to show for it. Maybe I have some stuff, but I wanted to be really specific on what kind of commercial 100%. I would want to get hired 100%. For. And so for those of you listening, if you have other people that are also videographers that want to level up with you, ask them, pitch them ideas, see what you guys can come up with, because there's such value in actually having something to show for it. And if someone comes to me and says, hey, we have this production, you're usually up against a couple other people. Recently I had a call for a production and I signed an NDA, so I can't say too much about it, but it was a really big job. And I usually, if you're, you know, up for commercial spots or whatever, you're up against a bunch of other people, a bunch of other creatives, other DPs. Maybe there's directors that they're talking to that have their own DPs as well. So tryouts. Yeah, it's tryouts.
You ever
yeah.
watch The Dark Knight?
Maybe. Oh. That's a perfect example.
Everyone in the comments, everyone in the comments of this video, just remind her to watch The Dark Knight. There's just a scene where the Joker's like, we're going to have tryouts. It's just reminding me of that.
Yeah.
Cultural reference.
Yeah.
She just watched Star Wars for the first time like 2 years ago. All right, guys. Anyways, so you were up against all these other cinematographers and what ended up happening?
So I lost the job and I first was super grateful to even get the call. So I wasn't even that pressed that I didn't get it. I would have been so excited if I did, mm-hmm. but it was a mix of just being grateful that I got the call. And number two, asking them, if you don't mind, what was the other direction you went with? Like what did this other person have?
It's like when you hand in an assignment in school and you're like, what could I have done better?
Just feedback. Yeah. Yeah. And so usually the production companies are open to offer feedback. And they said that they went with another director DP duo, and I don't have a director duo with me. But initially they just wanted a DP to shoot it. And so I guess during their creative process, they were like, oh, we should probably have a director as well come on and direct some of the images. And so when I saw who it was, I was like, oh, okay. Yep. That makes a lot of sense that they got the job, because they're extremely talented. They're repped too. Like they have an agency that's, I am just, you know, I'm independent. I don't have a rep right now.
I'm just a girl.
She gets TikTok references, guys. Yeah. We're fine on that side of the culture. She just got to start watching films. All right. Yeah. No, I think that's a really, you brought up the specific thing of making the thing you want to get hired for.
And yeah. And so that person that, you know, I'm saying, oh yeah, it makes sense that they got it. They have the work to show for it. They don't just have one or two pieces. They have
a catalog.
Eight.
Yeah.
Really good, solid pieces. So I'm super happy that they got it, because they're deserving of it. They've shown, they put in the hours, they've put in the work.
But it's more drive for you now saying, okay, I know what I've got to do next time in order to do this.
Yeah.
I have to create the work I want to be hired for. And I stress this to every single person who asks me my least favorite question, and I'm saying this in the most loving way to the people who are quote unquote that my audience, is how do I get to shoot the NBA? How do I get to shoot the NHL, the MLB? And it's that mindset, and it's that concept of you have to start working and making the stuff you want to get hired for.
Yep.
And I, like, in my own experience, like, I want to shoot more documentary stuff. I could shoot a commercial. I don't want to shoot a commercial. I can't do what you do. It scares the shit out of me. I don't like the idea of directing. I just don't like it. It's not my, but I would love to shoot documentaries at a really high level. I have a few, but not enough to justify for someone to hire me. So what am I doing now? Two things. I have a documentary in the works right now that I'm doing for free, the MMA one. Mm-hmm. And I'm also doing 10 short films with 10 different athletes, which is another way of kind of narrative documentary style filmmaking.
And we're doing one too.
And we're doing one because at the end of the day, if I want to do that in my career, I need to have work to show for it. So this just kind of reverts back to my main audience being sports related. If you want to shoot for a specific sport, league, team, organization, go and shoot your local teams, go and work and create that work you want to be hired for, because just like Nicole, you're going to be up against other people for the job.
Yep.
And I experienced that in my own way. When I got hired for the NHL, they were looking for someone who could edit videos quickly for social media. And my portfolio was full of that. So when it came time to the interview and it was down to me and a few other people, like, I had experience doing that. I crafted my early parts of my career doing that. So you can't just expect these commercials or gigs with the NBA to fall into your lap. You have to go out there and you're going to have to work for free. Sometimes you're going to have to do spec. Mm-hmm. And spec is actually something you've really built yourself on. And over the last two, 3 years, you really leaned into it. You did a jeans one with Kyle. You just did the Bumble one. We're doing one right now.
Mm-hmm. We did a tequila one with like a robot arm in December. I almost have maybe like one a month to show for.
Which is incredible.
And that's all that's on my portfolio because most of the time, not most of the time, but some of the client work that I do get, the client has full creative control. So it's not exactly representative of
what you want to do.
I would want to do. So yeah, there was one that, I guess it was this past summer. It was a commercial for a brand that I have known my whole life. And it went really well up until color. And I was like, no, I was so sad because the client wanted a specific color grade and I wanted a specific color grade and they were very different. Like sometimes color grades are, you know, it's a sprinkle of this, sprinkle of that. Yeah. But this was like, we wanted to look like Rec 709 and I wanted it to look stylized.
That's when director's cuts come in.
Yeah. And so we probably should have done a director's cut, to be honest. We didn't, but you know what? We probably could, but in that reference, I wasn't as proud to like post it or put it out on my portfolio, even though I still did. It was just like,
and I've experienced that too. Like there are some pieces I've done in my career for teams and organizations that like, do I want to do it? No, but I have to because it's my job. And in your case, it's like the client is paying you. And sometimes I think we glamorize the freelance life as like this thing where you can do anything you want. Like, no, you're still working for someone. You still have to deliver something that aligns with their brand, and their brand might not align with what you want to do.
Yep.
And that's just the nature of the game. And I'm kind of use this to segue here that you are also a full-time freelancer, which something that I think in sports is a little more rare than it is in the commercial space because it's easier to get access, easier to get, you know, in places with a team and part of like a full-time. And we've talked about this being a full-time versus a freelance employee. If you guys are curious, I'm going to link in her description. We did a whole series of videos and a full-length one, basically a podcast episode about being a freelancer versus a full-timer where we talk about it. But I'm not going to get into that because we already discussed it and I would rather.
At length.
So please go check it out on her channel.
So much information.
Go check it out on her channel. We really went into it, but I do want to, you know, dive into a little bit about your experience as a freelancer. You're not getting paid month to month. Like you're not getting a paycheck as frequently.
Yep.
You have low months, you have high months. You kind of have to organize your own schedule. And it's something that a lot of people are really interested in, but don't know how to get started in becoming a freelancer. Talk a little bit about your journey as a solo entrepreneur who owns her own business and kind of how you've grown in that space.
So I guess when I graduated, I actually was somehow recruited by a really small agency, super small. They were doing small business stuff, videos for them. And so that I was able through that, I was able to see kind of their structure of how they actually onboard clients and, you know, how to actually do that part of it. And it was a mix of understanding, okay, I can charge for weddings. I can charge for small businesses. At that point, like the year after I graduated, I was still working three jobs. As soon as I graduated, I was a cashier at Loblaws. I was a surf set instructor, which was like a fitness instructor that the company doesn't even exist anymore. And I was also working at Budweiser Stage in the summers doing merch. So I had three jobs at all times, sometimes two or three. I had that
too, yeah.
And you're funneling all of that income to do the things that you want to do. And a lot of the shoots that I would do, maybe they were like $200, $400, genuinely. Weddings I would do for like $300 or $400.
Which is insane.
Like, what? You're there for 12 hours.
For real.
Editing for 4 weeks or whatever it is.
If you guys don't know anyone getting married, go to @Caliente. Wedding Caliente. Films on TikTok, but I'm going to talk about that later. Anyways, go on.
Yes. So it was
subtle plug.
A little bit of that, as well as the internship, seeing how many weddings they could book. And there's just the structure.
You learn through the internships and the businesses you worked for, which is, I think, honestly, an advantage that not a lot of people have.
Yeah. I also had a huge advantage living at home. That's like a major thing. I didn't have crazy overhead bills to pay.
And that's such a key thing. Yeah. And I'm going to just really quickly, I don't mean to cut you off, but like when it comes to living your life and living at home, it's the biggest advantage you can have. And I will stress this, especially to the younger people out here who are just getting started. Like, don't be afraid of living at home because you're going to save money on utilities, bills, rent.
Yep.
I lived at home all for 5 years of university, and I was able to save a cushion of money that I don't touch, but mm-hmm. I know it's there in case something happens. When you, and it's also a lot better when you want to do more spec, you want to do more things like that. And also when you're starting off a business, you don't have to dump 50% of your earnings into your rent, which mm-hmm. in a city like Toronto, you're more dumping like 60% of it.
Yeah.
But go ridiculous. Keep going on with your, I would love to know a little bit more about like how you've developed your business and what practices work best for you and, you know, general tips for people to avoid when they're starting off as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, I don't know, this just came to mind now, but every time I would talk to a new potential client, they would usually ask me the same set of questions. If, you know, I'm saying, hey, I'd love to do a video for you, they would say, okay, what would this video look like? How, you know, what day would you want to do this on? That certain things, how long does it take? When would I get the final video? There are all of these normal questions that people ask. And so I took note of that and I made like a little small list of like, this is, if I'm going to approach somebody, I already have those details to present to them. So like, usually it would take me maybe 2 weeks or a week to get a first look to deliver to someone, you know, back in 2019 or 2020. So answering, like receiving all of these questions and just making sure that I am not wasting anybody's time, you know, when I'm reaching out, I'm like, okay, in terms of onboarding specifically, you're reaching out to these clients or they're reaching out to you and they're saying, hey, I want to do this thing. And I have very specific questions to ask them in order to, you know, quote properly or to onboard them so that they know exactly what they're getting. It's very much of a business transaction. And honestly, both my parents, they weren't entrepreneurs. My grandfather was, so maybe it was a genetic thing that I got it from him, but, yeah, it was, I didn't know what I was doing. I failed a lot.
But you learn, I think you learn as you do it.
You learn as you do it. But in terms of the learning, it means you're coming from a place of lacking knowledge, you know? So you have to make a lot of mistakes at the beginning. And I failed so fast. I failed up like so much. There was so many lessons that I learned. And yeah, it's just, I think.
But you learn from those failures. And I think that's a really good point to hang on for a sec. It's just like, you're gonna fuck up.
Yeah, you're gonna make mistakes.
It's not gonna be an easy ride, but I think that's part of being human and understanding in this industry. Like, it's like any other business. Like, you're gonna have months where you overspend or you're gonna miscalculate how much you're charging someone.
Yeah.
And you just learn.
Underquote. You know?
And I think you learn through experiences. And for people who are like trying to figure out how to get paid, like, and make a business out of this, like, you're not going to figure this out overnight. Like, this is a process. And I just made a YouTube video about this. Like, this shit, like, there's levels to this.
Yeah.
You're going to climb up the ladder at different paces than other people. And you just got to roll with it.
Yep.
When it comes to finances and money as a freelance cinematographer, and I know this is probably a little different from sports, but I still think it's a really good thing to talk about. How did you kind of land on your pricing structure, and how do you charge your clients? I think this is something that a lot of people, especially if you want to freelance, want to know, you know, how do you charge your clients? What's your structure like? And how do you kind of figure out your rate? And I always say my rate is never going to work for someone else in my world, because like, if someone asks me, hey, I want you to shoot a thing for this team. I've been shooting sports for 7 years and I shoot it at the highest level. You're going to be charged accordingly.
Yeah.
That's why I won't ever tell people like exactly how much I charge, not because I'm like gatekeeping or anything, but just because like, I'm going to give you my number and you're going to use it and it's not going to work.
Yeah.
But I only learn that through my own experiences and understanding the value of my work and the value of my effort. But how do you go about that process?
Yeah, two things. One, when I was working with agencies and other production companies hiring me, they would usually come with a budget. They'd say, hey, we only have $400 for this for you to camera operate for like 4 hours. And I was like, okay, cool. So it took a while to kind of collect all of these random rates that I was offered and kind of sit within that range. And as soon as the second thing is, as soon as your demand goes up, your price can also go up.
100%.
So if you're not really working and, you know,
someone offers you $400, you're going to be like more tempted.
You'll probably take it. Like if you're not getting a ton of clients right off the bat, which I definitely didn't at the start of my career, you're just kind of going with the flow. You're taking whatever they have and you're going to still perform to your best ability because you want you know, that to live on your portfolio, whatever you're doing. But yeah, that was the two things, is like receiving budgets and estimates from other agencies and then using that number as a base. And then as you, you know, get more inbound or you feel you're more busy, just start to increase a little bit here and there. And that's what I did. Like, I would start to increase slowly and slowly. I'd also look at my competitors. So I remember so specifically, I think it was probably 2021, where I was on someone's website. It was another freelancer in the industry, and they had their prices on their website. And I was like, I should be charging so much more.
There's a value to having transparency, but I think you also have to measure your skill set.
Yeah.
And like, I'm sure that you, when you were starting off, wouldn't charge us how much you were charging now, mm-hmm. right? Like old Nicole, you look at old Nicole's prices and be like, what was I doing? But young Nicole would look at you and be like, no one's going to hire me at those. So it's all a balance. It's a balancing act and understanding that like, you're going to grow into those bigger and bigger roles.
Yep. And supply and demand is a huge thing.
You're going to have slow months. You're going to have fast months. You just went through a stretch like over in January. And I remember you and I were talking about it. It was tough. How do you manage those low months?
Yeah. So my slow month actually started November, which was so early. Usually it starts December, January. Like December, January, February is usually the slow month for businesses. The
Don't want to spend money. It's the holidays.
Especially
it's the
end of the financial quarter. Especially because we live in Canada. We live in Toronto. It's winter. Nobody wants to shoot in the winter.
Their house.
Yeah. So
it's like, raining outside. You think I want to go outside right now?
Yeah. Oops. Especially for features and things that are longer format, that they usually exist in the summer because it's so much easier to operate in nicer weather. So for me, it started in November. And in general, a tip, if you are looking to get into freelancing, what I did before I even quit all of those, you know, quarter time, part-time jobs, I made sure that I had kind of enough of a quote salary from this, let's say like from 2019, I made this much money. I would live within those means for the next year. So I would never base it off like a check by check basis of like, oh, okay, I got $400 from this gig. I'm going to allocate that to whatever. It's like, that just goes into the abyss of the collective salary that I might be getting for the year. And by the end of the year, I think, oh, okay, I look at all my numbers. I look to see what my profit was, what my expenses was. And I can see either growth or growth in certain areas and look at, okay, for this next year, this is what I have to spend and kind of allocate in a year, like before, you know what I mean? Like I estimate
using what you made the last year kind of deal. And then you work with it. But I think that's a really big thing, is like learning to live within your means.
Yeah, totally.
And like, yeah, you could make six figures 1 year. It doesn't mean you're going to make six figures the next year.
Yeah. There's a YouTube video. Sorry to interrupt you. There's a YouTube video I was watching recently about someone who was significantly growing really quickly on YouTube. She did a whole breakdown on what happened. And there's something that's called lifestyle creep. And I a little bit experienced this. And so it was the fact that after a year, or I guess it was a couple of years of me trying to do this freelance thing, I was like, man, like maybe I can move out. And I was like, oh, maybe I can like get a new car. Maybe I should upgrade my camera. And then you start thinking of, oh, I have this like, you know, salary that I made. Let me directly reinvest right away. Let me upgrade my life. And sometimes that's like, it's so exciting to think about.
I've been there.
But yeah, like I had to wait at least a year so that I had saved up a good chunk of my rent money before I moved out. Like there were certain things where I made sure to pause and not, you know, creep that lifestyle of, oh, like I can order out food today. Like I just made $400 yesterday. What's $20 here?
You fall into the trap and then you realize like, oh, $500 goes real quick.
Goes real quick. Yeah. So that's just another financial tip that I had to be aware of when freelancing, is the money that you're getting from jobs. It's not that number. That number is subtracted by your Adobe subscription, taxes. your taxes, like your rent, like all of these subscriptions you pay. Like it's not that number. It's significantly lower and it's spread out through the whole year. So it's peanuts compared to what you actually think you're making that day.
What are your goals for 2024 in terms of your business?
So Look, comparing 2022 and 2023, my previous goal, which affects my current goal, my previous goal was to increase my production value. That was it. It was like, I want to just make things and I want them to have, I want to work within bigger sets and like just do bigger productions and get paid for those bigger productions. And so what happened was my gross income increased, but my net income stayed the same. And so that means I wasn't paying myself. I was paying myself the exact same that I was in 2022, that I was in 2023, but my gross income, which is basically all of the income that you get, that you receive
before you split it up and send, you pay people and all that,
people or taxes or whatnot. It was like, I think more than 50% of an increase, which was insane, but I didn't get any of that.
So now it's just like, maybe you want to give yourself a little cut more of the pie.
I didn't get any of that financially, but the work shows for it. So it's kind of a domino effect of like, I invested so much into paying subcontractors, into just investing in the actual production quality. And that work will then hopefully translate into next year. And then I can appropriately quote that way. So yeah, this year.
Give yourself a little bit more slice of the cake.
Yeah. And you know, like.
Treat yourself a little bit.
Properly charge for production rates. Properly charge companies that are asking me to do stuff. Because there's a lot of sometimes nickel and diming. Yes. There's a lot of undercutting.
And price checking.
Like, yeah. So
just that's to my whet goal people's appetite here. And to kind of give you an idea of what you've been doing this for roughly 5 years now, what's been the highest paying project you've done? Just to show people what's capable. You don't need to say the brand, you don't need to say, but like, what is the highest paying project that you've worked on so far as a DP? Because again, people aren't really as honest about this. And I think having that transparency to show people it's possible to make a career out of this is really important.
Yeah. The highest was 75 grand.
So keep that in mind. Like,
none of that went to me, by the way. It's just the project in itself. You know, you have multiple shoot days. I was responsible for tons of subcontractors. Like, not all of that 75K lands in my bank account, but then it quickly goes away and it gets paid out to all of these people. But still,
to land a project of that value is crazy.
It was insane. I was not prepared to receive that project. And still to this day, I think about that project. It's probably the best and worst thing that's ever happened in my career. But yeah, there's so many lessons learned when you deal with that much money as well.
I think I know exactly which project this is.
And you probably do.
I know exactly what project, but it's a really cool project. And I remember you working on it and the headache that came with it, but it's also something that's incredible to have on your portfolio and a situation that a lot of people probably wish that they could experience.
Yeah.
And so I think you should be really proud of it. I'm going to keep pivoting here. Cause you know, we got a time limit.
We got so many topics.
We got a lot of topics. I really quickly want to touch on being a woman in the space, in the commercial space, in the DP space, in the creative world. This is something that you are very strongly opinionated about and you have a very strong belief system about working with more women, about empowering other women. I, to a degree, get it. Being Latino, I am underrepresented in my own space as, you know, someone who's Colombian. There's not a lot of like Latino people working in sport.
100%.
I can't imagine though being a woman in the creative industry in general, like being like that. There is a barrier there, right?
Yeah.
Can you just give us, you know, some pieces of advice for if there are any female listeners, which I'm sure there are at some point.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know how to tackle that and how to deal with being in this position and also to, you know, capitalize on being a very talented woman in this industry.
Yeah. So one thing I'll say that I had leverage on getting into the space was I was a strength and conditioning coach before this. Like, I would run teams through workouts and mainly guy teams, like men's teams in university. So I was super comfortable being the only girl in the room, little 5'4" girl telling me
just the girl.
She was a fairy, you know, like T-Pain just doing the circles.
I'm spinning like a ballerina.
So yeah, like I kind of had a upper hand and I'm super grateful for that because that took a lot of, it was courage. It was also fake it till you make it. It was just faking confidence, walking in, making sure you know exactly what you're talking about.
Over preparing.
Preparing
for the worst, where the worst might not happen.
Yeah. And I was super comfortable in those spaces because I was used to that. I, you know, 6 a.m. wake ups, working out with either the hockey team, the basketball team, the football team, like just so many things like that. So I was used to being in that space. And I was also used to, as a fitness instructor as well, I was used to being in a room, being the lead. Like, people have to listen to me whenever.
Yeah.
We would do a class, so I'm trying to.
You had the advantage of being able to be in those rooms with
feeling the spotlight
as a woman. You had that advantage, and so you clearly translated that over efficiently and as cleanly as you could to the DP and commercial space.
So if you don't necessarily have those experiences, I think the one I'll definitely say this right off the bat, my entire career, I've been supported by the men in this industry. You are a perfect example of that. There's so many guys that I have surrounded me and they're surrounded myself with, and they have been nothing but supportive. Like, they are just the coolest guys. Like, that I've never really felt like a cold shoulder or like a, oh, this is a boys club. Like, you don't belong here. Like, I've really not felt that way. So I just want to shout out all the guys that have really built my career up, especially any of the YouTube channels that I watch. Like, Danny's a perfect example. Wandering DP is another perfect example. They're both dudes, but they're so educated. They're so talented. Like, the gender thing, it doesn't, at first, like, you don't really feel it. And so there was a time, I talked about this on actually a video that I recently made called Dear Female Filmmakers. You can watch that here.
Subtle plug.
If you're watching on YouTube. Subtle plug. But there was a time where, I'll just be super transparent, it was a shoot for TEDx, and all the homies were on it. Like, Akeem was on it, Nick was on it. Like, there were a couple homies that I was like, hey, let's do this.
The fellas.
This shoot, the fellas, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure I was producing it or DPing it or something. And it was just a bunch of like interviews, TED Talks, where people are just talking.
Yeah, everyone knows TEDx.
So I remember probably 3 or 4 hours in, and I remember looking around the room and being like, oh shit, I'm the only girl here. And I did the hiring. Like,
it was in your hands.
It was in my hands. Like, the bias lies within me. So you would think, because I'm a woman, I would want to hire other women. But the accessibility of, like, knowing where all these women are, it's low.
It's like in The Office. You watch The Office?
Yeah.
It's like, Michael, where are all the hot people? Where are all the women DPs?
Literally. So there's so many that I could shout out right now that are also very talented women. But I think there's always a gray line. I talk about this like specifically in that YouTube video, because I wanted to be so careful of how I phrase it. But there has to be merit above everything else, as well as being aware of optics.
It's a tightrope.
It's like there has to be a balance. Like, you shouldn't be hiring someone just because they're a woman. Like, I really don't think that that's the way to go about it. But if you have someone who is talented
and is a woman,
maybe think about the balance of the team that you're creating. Like, for the Bumble piece that we just did, I would say, I think it was 76% or 70% women.
I wasn't on set, but the credit list is like, you had the gals out.
And that was also unintentional. Like, I didn't really, like, it's always in the back of my head of trying to have a balance.
But I think that's just you changing your internal bias.
Yeah.
And also, I think, you know, fully acknowledging the fact that you're working, maybe it was because you were working with Bumble and it was more of a female.
Yeah, the theme was Galentine's. It was females. Girly. It was,
so maybe there was something there. I do think it's a really interesting topic, though, and I wish we had more time to do it, because, like, even in the sports scene, like, again, I can really relate, and as a Latino in a very, very different situation. But, you know, there's always that question of, like, who should you choose to be on air?
Yeah.
Who should you choose to be on camera?
Yeah.
And
it's always sticky.
And it's interesting, because, like, I went to school and I have a lot of friends who work in the sports industry still. It's a very, like, do you bring in new blood or do you go with the people who are proven? And it really is like a balance here. And, like, I truly do believe in visibility, and you know, people will see you and want to be like
Completely agree. That's why also, Cassie Athena was, you
yeah,
know,
exactly. But also,
she can do it, I can
are
do
you
too.
Willing to compromise on the quality of one part of the production because you want that? And it really, I think it really starts walking a tightrope. And like, for me, like if I'm working on a female piece, whether it's a documentary or a short film in sports, I would rather have women there because it's part of the experience that I can't understand.
Yeah.
But again, you have to toe a line here of, do you want to be inclusive and caught at the cost for the production?
Yeah.
And I think eventually as you grow, you meet people who give you that level of value.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. It's of the creative.
Yeah, it's like, mixing the two. Like you have to be also good at the job. But like that being said, it's good to have that in the back of your mind. Like if I'm ever working on a female piece, like I'm going to think of you to DP it because you not only are you are a very good DP who is also a woman.
So going back to this example of when I lost that job, literally the first thing that the producer on the phone call said to me was like, we really want to diversify who we're hiring for this like series. And we came across your account. Like they literally Googled Toronto female DOP. And I was one of the first like Google searches to come up, which SEO is doing great things. But I was like, oh, interesting. Like that's cool. But then losing the job to two guys, a director and DP duo, like there's no shade because they went with the more talented people. Like I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh, I'm better than them, because I'm really not. Like they're repped. They have way more experience. Like it made sense.
And it obviously made sense for them in the production, the story they want to tell and the budget they had.
Yeah.
And I think you took that in stride.
Yeah.
Just hearing about that, I think you took that on the chin in a good way, and you learn from it, and you're just now using it as a way to propel yourself forward.
Yep.
Before we move on here, can you just give a piece of advice to the ladies, to the younger girls out there who may want to get into this field, whether it's sports, whether it's commercial, and give them one piece of advice that you would have given yourself back when you started off?
I would say to just get really good at what you want to do. Like we're in a really cool time right now where visibility is important to companies. So like I maybe wouldn't have gotten that call otherwise for her to just say like, hey, we want to focus on visibility, even though I'm not, you know, the most, you know, talented person for the job. I still got a call. So if you are hesitant about it, please don't be, because there are so many jobs out there where people are actually actively looking for women in these roles. So we do kind of have a bit of a leverage, and I'm going to ride it. Like, why not? Right. And
you got to take handouts when you're given them.
Yeah. So
they don't come very often. And when they do, you got to just ride that wave. And I totally agree with you.
Yeah. So I just like, keep your head down, keep like, make friends with whoever, like, I don't know. It really comes down to like you as a human and as a creative. If you're super awesome and fun to work with, if you're super talented at what you do, like people will not have the chance to tell you no. Like they will only have
do everything you can to make it the hardest no that they've ever said.
Yeah, 100%. So that's amazing. My advice, I would think. The gender thing, it's so sticky, but it shouldn't be like the first thing.
And it also shouldn't keep you from doing this. Like,
oh yeah.
You know, like I think I've seen more women on sidelines shooting sports. I've seen so many women on set. Like, you know, I don't know many Latinos doing this, but it's really cool to see that the growth is happening on the women's side of the industry. And I think that's really impactful. We're going to move on here really quickly, just because we do have a time set here for us to stop recording.
Yeah.
I put out ask for some questions. I'm going to take like two or three of them that I really like. We're not going to go through every one of them.
Yeah.
And we're going to get you to answer them. The first question comes from Diego Giovanni. One, as a DOP, what is your approach with working with other departments? Would love a few tips for beginners.
Yeah.
Smiley emoji.
Yeah. So with other departments, when I first started, it's usually your friends. So the first thing I would say is be overly communicative. So express exactly what you want from all of these departments as a DOP specifically, but also express, hey, I'm hiring you, so bring your creative juices. Being able to have the communication flow really well and expressing that there at least on my sets, especially working with so many different departments, there should, the ego should be checked at the door. Those are like my two big things, is like, tell me things often, communicate it, say whatever's on your mind, say any ideas you have, and I will be receptive. And I hope that it's the same in return. That's like the one thing, communicating with all these people that have so many ideas and they want to share their voice. It's like,
just make it an open room, open mic.
Open mic. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and just don't take things personally. I think leaving ego at the door is such a big thing that we don't acknowledge. And I really like that. Christian Angelini asks, what are the most important pre-production responsibilities for a DOP when you're hired for a shoot?
Pre-production, shout out Frame Set, shout out Canva, shout out Milano. These are the three big players that I use when in pre-production. You have to create the images. You have to show people exactly what you're looking for. And there's so many references out there. So Frame Set is specifically the one that I use. I used to use Shot Deck, but they were more movie heavy. So again, out of touch a little bit with the movie.
But I mean,
stuff,
it's also different. Movies and commercials are so different.
Super different, yeah. So Frameset has the commercial link, the music video links, like all of that. And to make your decks look very pretty and presentable, that's the Canva link. And then Milanote is where, I mean, it's a combination of, for me as a producer, it's a combination of Google Sheets for production Bibles and Milanote, but Milanote is a much more visual platform. So anything with pre-production, it's like organization and make it look pretty, because the organization will sell them on, okay, this person I can trust and she's going to be dedicated to checking all of the boxes that we need, and making it look pretty is just the optics of,
you look professional,
furthering the trust.
It's like building out your camera rig. People are going to see you with a big rig versus a little camera. And you're like, even though we could have the same camera and I just bring my FX3 and you bring your rigged out, they're going to go with you because like big camera equals big money.
Yeah.
I love that. We have a little bit more time here, so I'm going to throw another one on you.
The bottom left
that,
one.
We'll get to that one in a second. Yeah, how do you get more? And so this is an interesting one. The question by Prismatic Verse is, how do you get more experience in learning lighting? And now you're not a self-proclaimed expert at lighting.
Yep.
But it's something you've expressed to me that you want to learn.
Yeah.
Right? So how are you going to go on and improve your skills as a DOP? Because that is, anyone who's a DOP, you said it, shaping light. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you will have a gaff, you will have a light, someone lighting like Will. Shout out Will.
Shout out Will.
But how do you, I think this is a really good opportunity for people to know, you're still going to be learning in this little path 5 years down the line.
Yep.
How are you going to improve your lighting, and how can someone take that and improve their own skill with light?
Spec work. That is like the biggest thing for me is like on the Bumble shoot, on the Jean shoot, both of those times, specifically the Bumble one, we did a location scout, and on the location scout, we took photos of exactly which angles we wanted and had, Sydney or Andre sit in as the talent. And with those photos on my iPad, I literally doodled, okay, if I want the key coming from here, if I want her to be, far side key, so her shadow is towards camera, where am I placing the light? How am I placing it? That like I'm drawing out all of these things, and I don't think I ever did that before. Like I don't think I've ever actually drawn it, and that helped me so much.
We did it with the BWHL thing.
We did that
BWHL. We planned a whole grid, and we were just hunched over my iPad drawing it. And I think when we do the breakdown, we're going to show that visualizing the light and actually. And I think a big thing that I'm going to add on to this is actually just taking the time, taking a day to go and do it.
Yeah.
We just did the PWHL Toronto Media Day. And I think one of the biggest takeaways for me, and one thing I'm going to say when we eventually do a breakdown video, is that we took two whole days, an afternoon and an evening, to go look at the set, like a scout, and then set it up or mock it up.
Yep.
And I think those 2 days in mocking the lighting and trying different things were A, really essential in getting the final image and the final vision we had to life. But number two, it was really easy to communicate with our gaffer Will, and saying, look, this is what we wanted to do.
Showing him the physical drawing
and the example footage. And so he was really quickly able to lock in, say, okay, I know exactly where to do it. And it came out great. And we haven't been able to show it up. Maybe when this is released, we will. But I think taking the time to prep and putting yourself in an uncomfortable situation. Like neither of us are good, like experienced at lighting. I think we can light. I just don't think we're not experienced as other people.
We're not like the Wandering DP where he's like, throw this floppy up here.
But I think it's really important to learn that side.
And you have to actually do it because there's another example from an e-commerce shoot I recently did, and they had a very specific reference photo. And I was like, how am I going to light this? I'm racking my brain. And we had a full prep day allocated. So I asked my friends, that's another thing you can do is ask other gaffers that have lit certain things, be like, how did you light this? Just curious if you're able to share that knowledge or whatever, specifically friends, because they'll probably say yes. And so I remember asking and showing Andre actually this reference image, and he was like, oh, maybe you could just start with a simple three-point lighting setup and then maneuver it and see what happens. And on the day, I did the lighting setup and it did not look at all like the reference image, and it's nothing to do with Andre at all. It was just the space and like the lights that I had access to. But when we took the time to just be like, okay, maybe if we bounce light up here, let's turn these off, and it ended up working. So now going forward, if I have that kind of reference, I know exactly what kind of lighting to do. So me being able to just do it and have hands-on experience, move the lights around, see exactly what light is doing when it hits objects, like that will sink in for future projects. Well, it's...
We got a thunderstorm.
I love that answer. Going to move on to the last question we're going from the audience here. If you could do it all over again, what would you have done differently? Coming from Fabio M Films.
Yes.
That's a great question.
Two things that I would like to do differently. One is to, I mean, obviously hindsight is 2020, so I don't know if I actually would have known to do this. Specifically because I didn't know that commercial cinematography was even a thing. If I had that goal earlier on, I would have probably worked at a rental house. And I don't really hear that many people saying that, but
it's true.
It's if I had worked at a rental house, I would have had my hands on an Arri. I would have had my hands on a Red. I would have just seen what all of these
what
words
you're capable
are
and
these
of and
things,
what you're able to do. Yeah, with the high end stuff,
bits and pieces and all. Like I, you know, up until 2 years ago, I'm like, what the heck's a Teradek? You know, like what?
I still don't know what a Teradek is.
It's like a transmitter, you know, but it's like all of these little bits and bobs.
We're gonna start wrapping this up now. I have some really quick rapid fire questions I asked all my guests. I will ask you them, answer them in as little few words as possible. If you could only use one lens for the rest of your career, what would it be?
Oh dear. Should I say this? The Helios.
That's fine. I think it's fire.
So like, you know, people might roll their eyes. If anybody doesn't know what the
Helios is. Anyone who's rolling their
like
eyes is kidding themselves because they know that thing looks incredible.
It looks so gorgeous.
Whatever those Soviets were doing in like the 1950s developing that lens in like Russia. Kudos to you guys.
It's such a beautiful
You're still
lens.
Relevant in 2024. What's the worst gear purchase you've ever made? Something you don't use that's gathering dust. Something that you just think maybe just you shouldn't have spent the money on. Just straight up bad gear.
I'm gonna probably say those like macro extension tubes. Like I bought them once. Filters.
They're just chilling.
Yeah. Oh, a prism. If you guys are still buying prisms, don't buy a prism. Jesus. Like the little, you know what I'm talking, where you like hold it in front of the lens and you see the rainbows. Like just, oh God, no, it doesn't work.
what's your biggest creative pet peeve? Asking the hard questions.
Creative pet peeve when people don't tag me in posts.
Okay, that's fair. No, you know what? Fair. Like, that's fair. Who is your dream client? Or, you know, give me three dream brands that you want to work with. This light just went out. That's fine. We're almost at the end
of
the episode.
We're almost at the end. Let's wrap it up.
The hair light just went out. Give me three dream brands.
Oh, no.
Fuck.
Oh, we're dying all
no!
over the
place. We're just going to keep rolling here. I'm going to get on the second camera because we're pretty much done. I just hope this one lasts. We're in the second camera angle here.
I think my dream clients would be Sony or Red. Like the clients that I'm actually the gear that I'm shooting with, like those would be superb clients. But I think one client that I've always wanted to work for is like like Garage. It's like a women's clothing brand.
Yeah, no, I remember Garage.
Yeah, so I don't know. So like clothing brands like that, which would be really cool. Okay. And yeah, I guess I'm not no shade to Garage, but I'm not really shooting for the stars. Like I could be saying like Chanel or like, you know, like YSL, like all of those luxury brands that would be really cool. But yeah, I don't know. I'm very open with brands. Like I think in general, my ideal brand would be so open creatively and they would be willing to do something that's funny or like funky. Like I love
mix
those.
It up.
Yeah. Just something.
Love it.
Yeah. Super Bowl-esque. That's the goal. Super Bowl-esque.
Okay,
style.
Cool. What is the most overdone trend in the video space right now?
Ooh, overdone trend. Do you have one?
I'm guilty of it.
Oh,
like I love halation and bloom so much, but it's overdone, but I love it.
Yeah.
Film grain overdone, but I love it. Like those are mine.
Oh, I think overdone would be like a film flash, you know, like a transition of like a, but it's like really intense. Like the opacity is not at like 20%.
It's like I'm a big, like if you're going to do halation, if you're going to do bloom, if you're going to do any film stuff, like in everything in moderation.
Yeah, moderation. Like, yeah. If you got like a film flare every clip.
Yeah, like you gotta be smart with it.
Yeah. I think like as I grew, the less effects I used.
And I think that's the same with
it's
me. And I use effects in my work, but I use it in moderation. Yeah, I'm not just like I would just go crazy. And I'm looking at my old videos and I wanna puke. Finally, you kind of answered this, but I kind of want to broaden it. What is one piece of advice you would give to a younger creative who may want to follow in your footsteps or find work in the professional? I usually say sports world, but in the creative world, what's one piece of advice you'd give to someone who's starting off and might be looking up to you or following your footsteps?
So when someone who is younger comes to me and says like, hey, like I really want to work on set with you. Mm-hmm. The thing that makes me immediately say absolutely yes, I will keep you in mind for the next time is if they have a great personality. If I will get along with you as a person, I would love to have you on a set because you're with these people for a long time and you're even during pre-production, like me and Sydney, the girl that directed Bumble, we were chatting for like over a month for that project and then also another month after we shoot because of post-production. So like you want to be with these people for a while. So yeah, there's a couple of people on that project that at the end of the shoot, they were like, oh my God, like I follow your stuff or like, I want to be on more sets with you. And I'm like, honestly, yeah, because you were so funny. Yeah. You were so easy to work with.
Good vibes,
like wanting to be there. I've worked with some people that are just like, you know, they're yawning or they're just like no sense of urgency. And I'm like, there's so many other people that would be like,
yeah,
what do you want? Like, let's do, like, they're just excited and hyped to be there. So that's the piece of advice is just, if you are genuinely passionate about this industry, it will show and don't be afraid to hide it. Like,
it's like that another TikTok reference. Do you want to form an alliance with me?
Yes.
Yes. I do. All right. We're going to wrap it up here. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You ripped me earlier saying it took you episode 14 to get me on here. I got you on here. You've been on the YouTube channel already. No, but thank you for giving your insights. Thank you for giving your advice and your story. I really appreciate you. Where can the people find you? Everything's going to be linked down in the link below, but where can they find you?
Yeah, we're on Instagram, nshaps, TikTok, nshaps.prod, and then YouTube is also nshaps, Nicole Shapiro.
Awesome. Also, kudos to you for getting here on time today. You didn't follow NST. Yep. For anyone who knows Nicole, if I say be here at 1, she's going to be here at 2:30, but she made it here on time and we got this podcast done.
NST, Nicole Standard Time.
If you're watching this, just comment below and say good job and not leaning on NST.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. Thank you guys for watching. Thank you guys for listening. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like, subscribe, leave me a comment down below. Leave Nicole questions. She's probably going to come on and probably answer a few out there.
Yeah.
If you're on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, leave me a rating. Let me know what you think of the show. And that does it. Thank you for coming on. And we'll catch you guys next time.
Thanks for watching.
Peace.
Bye.